She's fine.
She's coming.
Oh, okay, good.
She'll be here a little later.
Oh, okay.
Well, I'm all set.
You all set?
Yeah, I'm a ready, teddy, not a ruined drawing.
Okay. Well, we're going to get started.
Oh, sure. You can give me a little introduction. Make it about this small.
I definitely will that way. So welcome, and my name is Mocha, for those who are here for the first time, and we wanted to welcome you. We are extremely honored and feel really privileged to have Dr. Cooper as a guest today, and the title of our of tonight's event was titled A Conversation with Dr. Cooper. Yes, because we definitely are excited about A Conversation with Dr. Cooper, but we just couldn't figure out exactly which angle to approach. and I'll be pretty candid, you know, ever since we started the Community Dialogue series, he was one of the persons that we thought about earlier on, but we're like, you know, what would be the best way to kind of get him, you know, to talk about something that he's passionate about at the center. And after many months of processing and I'm meeting with him three times, we came up with a conversation with Dr. Cooper. So that's I'm sure we're going to have a phenomenal time, and it's going to be a lot of information shared. But really, I also felt that I'm particularly very excited to welcome Dr. Cooper, in part because in Cameroon, but in many French-speaking parts of Africa, you'd refer to him as the Baobab, you know. So, and in that situation, the Baobab is referred to as someone with very strong character, very strong personality, who is kind of, I won't use the word omnipresent, but just kind of like, you know, something close to that, you know. I'd like to say we're going to welcome at the Baobab, a Baobab of Rochester, and again, many who are aware of what the Baobab is about, it sort of has multi purposes. You know, the leaves can be used for relishes. You know, the ladies pound the leaves into fine dust and add it to starch and helps with digestion. It also has medicinal properties. The leaves, the fruit, also used for feeding. The wood is not used for as firewood per se, but its fibrous properties allow it to store a lot of water during the hot season. So when it rains and the water settles in the trees, you could actually use it as a reservoir for hard times. And also, the roots are also used for medicinal purposes. And they flower probably only maybe a few weeks or a few months at most during the year, announcing the arrival of spring. So when you think about all those analogies, I think you start seeing many aspects of Dr. Cooper's life, you know, definitely in all the agencies and institutions that he's either founded, worked with, or continues to support, either based on his knowledge or his philanthropic interests, you know, all speak to sort of, the essence of the Baobab tree. So we're definitely a pleased to have you here, Dr. Cooper, and hopefully you have a great evening. I'm just going to give a little bit about, actually, I had two pictures of Baobabs, and I talked about it without showing them, but this is one here that is a Baobab that is old, and you can see people meet around the Baobab tree here, so I pass this around, but the rims on the tree are the people live up in the hills. This is in Mali. They scrape the back of the tree and make rope, and it's believed that they used to climb the cliffs with the ropes from the Baobab tree. So again, and this is another Baobab, just if you want to see the full tree, and you see how it grows and very very resilient plant. You know, so I pass this around, and you can enjoy them. And a shameless plug, if you wanted any of those, the big tiles are $30, and the small ones on the same pictures with sayings $20, and that's one way to support the center. So let's see. In terms of other dialogue series, we have this last couple of months we've been focusing on sustainability, you know, and definitely Dr. Cooper might address that theme, even though he may not be prepared to do so, but we are going to be talking about earthen architecture in July, and we're inviting an artist from Ghana. So you see the themes here, the photo exhibit here that you see from Jim Novak. He's a retired teacher in Fairport Schools, and developed an interest in building schools in Africa and has traveled to Kenya multiple times and done projects. And one thing that is kind of easily lost in translation is that earthen architecture was a very fundamental part of humanity in Africa and many parts of the world, but the huge displacement of people, particularly post-slavery, you know, a lot of the technique was lost. So now people are building very, if you will, not technically sound houses, not because of, you know, mud houses or earthen houses are not good. It's just that the technique has been lost. So we decided to take a special interest in promoting awareness on earthen architecture. And at least 40% of the world's children live in mud houses. So a lot of the exhibits we'd have in June, July, leading all the way to September, would be all promoting awareness around earthen architecture and all its benefits, especially with respect to a safe environment and energy conservation. So I just want to throw that out there. And our next dialogue is going to be by Ken Bell, who is also known to many people in the community. And he's going to be talking about, you know, our personal balance sheets. And he feels very passionate that a lot of the housing issues that we're seeing right now is because people lost their focus on their personal balance sheet and decided to take risks that were totally unnecessary. So he would get into a little bit of that. But you see, what we're trying to do at the Baobab is just to get people talking, get the conversation going. So we are very delighted that you're joining us tonight for a conversation with Dr. Cooper. That said, I'm going to welcome Dr. Cooper, and he's going to have anywhere from 15 to 20 minutes, after which, you know, we're going to have lots of, we can grill Dr. Cooper for once, right?
Well, good evening. I didn't know what to talk about, but I thought that since my life certainly represents what I would call a journey of an African American to realize his dreams. I was taught by my mother that dream the impossible, even though there are barriers. You can, if you believe hard enough and you work hard enough and maintain a focus, you can realize your dreams. And I can remember in 1936, she told me that you're a young black boy, but remember, you're just as good as Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And he was the president then. I felt somewhat puzzled, but always remembered that. And I would imagine today, if a parent who's interested in the future of their children would give them a similar message, but the message today would be, you're not only as good as the president of the United States, but you too can become, in the future, the possible president of the United States. And I think that's the quantum jump which has taken place in our society. There are real problems yet, but I think that if you dream and you dream big and you're willing to pay a price, then you can realize your dreams. I thought I'd give you, I think lots of people in this area know my involvement in various organizations, but I thought I would give you a little background which I consider was necessary and set the foundation for whatever success that I have derived out of this society. I'm the grandson, great-grandson of a slave. My father's grandfather was a man by the name of Wes Henson. He was born into slavery in 1853. He was the offspring of a plantation owner by the name of Henson in the Panhandle area of Florida. Henson in the late 1840s went to Alabama and purchased some slaves. Among the slaves purchased was a 15-year-old Cherokee Indian maiden. He brought her back to Henson, Florida, of course, had at least three children by her. One of them was Wes Henson, my great-grandfather, and he had two sisters. Wes Henson was born in 1853. He lived until 1946. I still have aging relatives in Florida who remember him as a senior citizen. Wes Henson lived in the big house since he was the offspring of the plantation owner, and one of his responsibilities was to take the provisions out into the field for the slaves. And he knew when they were planning to escape because they would start hoarding food. So that's the background. Wes Henson married a very African-looking woman by the name of Florence Caldwell, and they had 9 children. Amongst them was Leela Henson, my grandmother, who married a man by the name of Madison Cooper, my father, my grandfather, and my father was one of his sons by the name of Alonzo. My mother was born in Georgia. She had 9 years of education. My father, in Florida, after Plessy versus Ferguson in 1896, he had 0 days of education. He started work full-time at age 8 in a sawmill in Florida. They were migrant and tenant farmers, my parents. They migrated north in 1921, and they came to western Pennsylvania. Why? Because there were coal mines and steel mills. And for a person who had a strong back and not any education, he could find economic outlets for his family. So they settled in 1921 in Clairton, Pennsylvania, which is 14 miles southeast of Pittsburgh in the Monongahela River area. And you have along the Monongahela River such communities as Denora, Manessa, Monongahela, Homestead, Glassport, McKeesport, and then finally you get into Pittsburgh if you go west. So the town itself, where we lived during the, and I can remember this because I was born just before the Depression and lived during the Depression years. Housing segregation was minimal because everybody was poor. And so the mobility in housing was not just limited to color. And the composition of the community of 20,000 to 25,000 was multi-ethnic, multi-racial. The steel mill and the coal mines attracted a large number of people from Serbia, Croatia, Greece, Mexico even, and the Poland, Russia. So my classmates represented essentially a United Nations. So I grew up in that kind of atmosphere, and I didn't have any myths or stereotypes about people who were different. We had a small Jewish community, and so the schools themselves were highly integrated. The non-white population was only about 8 to 10% of the community. My father worked 44 years, firstly in coal mines and then in the steel mill. The community composition, I guess in the household, it was very interesting. There were eventually 7 children. Everyone graduated from high school. 5 went on to college. But what exemplified the household was there was always plenty newspapers, magazines, and books. In fact, we had an unabridged dictionary in the house as early as 1939. Now, the neighborhood in which we lived, across the street, for example, from where we lived, there was a family from Czechoslovakia. Not very close by, our next door neighbors were from Italy. And then there were people from just the southern Europe, all dispersed throughout the community. So we went to schools, they were all integrated. I never had more than five or six black Americans in a class. The teachers were all white, primarily female. But during my childhood days, the cream of the crop of women could either teach or go into nursing. So I was the beneficiary of the cream of the crop of teachers who happened to be women. Women were not allowed to marry and maintain their position as a teacher in the school district. I think the academic situation was very challenging. I was in high school. I chaired the history department. I was always interested in history. because in the household, we subscribe to several newspapers, and we also received the Pittsburgh Courier. The Pittsburgh Courier those days had, as columnists on their editorial page, people like J.A. Rogers, who wrote 1,000 Amazing Facts about colored Americans. And it had in it people, historical figures, such as Antonio Maceo, who fought in the Cuban Revolution against Spain. And it had just a wide range of historically relevant people of color. And we had discussions in the household about local politics, national politics, and international politics. And my oldest sister, I was number 3 out of 7. My oldest sister was a member of the Book of the Month Club in the late 30s. I can still remember a title of one of her books. It was Shanghai 37 by Vicky Baum. And it was kind of an intellectually stimulating environment in the household. However, at age 12, because of the insistence by a courageous African-American doctor in our community that blacks have the opportunity to swim in the swimming pool at our park just like everyone else, he was able to get an injunction because the city fathers said that, we will allow blacks to swim 3 days a week and whites 4. Now, imagine this. Here's a relatively modern high school built 1927 that we swam together. In fact, the boys swam nude in the swimming pool in school. Yet, now the city father said, well, we aren't going to have integrated swimming. So this doctor, Joseph A. Randall, a real hero, a graduate from Howard University's medical school in 1927, he was able to get a judge to file an injunction against the city of Clairton, and it closed the pool for about 3 years. It was interesting, the judge, Judge Smith, was from an all-white town very near Pittsburgh called Mount Lebanon, and he was the one who filed the injunction against the city of Clairton. During the time of that discussion and conflict situation, the Klan in the area, and there was a Ku Klux Klan in the area, they burned a huge cross across the river from the Monongahela River from Clairton, so it was obvious to the residents of Clairton that you could see this Ku Klux Klan cross burning one night. But that did not deter Dr. Joseph A. Randall. So he was a real hero at an early age. School was challenging and it was good, but there were a couple crises in school. And remember, this is during World War II. And when I was an eighth grader, the American Legion, which was all white, gave to the outstanding male and female students a medal. And they did not even have me among the nominees, and I had a 96 average for the year, and I participated in extracurricular activities, football, basketball, track and field. So I was very disappointed. My homeroom teacher, and I'll never forget her, Sarah McVeigh Patterson, she asked me to stay after school. So she came to my locker, put her arms around me and said, well, you deserve this medal, but a bigoted group of men who ought to know better have denied you of this award. But you're made of firmer stuff. I have confidence in you that you will not allow this little incident to deter you from whatever you want to become. And I still maintain contact with that teacher. She's in her 90s and she lives in Atlanta, Georgia. The other issue, once I got into high school, was that there was an unwritten law within the athletic department that black girls could not be cheerleaders. Now, the football squad, even though we were only about 8 to 10% of the student population, the football squad was 30% black. So we won 4 straight games, and then I got the idea. I said, well, our next opponent is a McKeesport, our traditional rivals. So why don't, instead of reporting to practice on Monday, everybody report to my parents' low-cost defense housing apartment. So I told my mother, and she was always behind whatever I wanted to try. And so the football squad went on a one-day strike. The black football players went on a one-day strike against the team. So that broke. That began to break the prohibition of black girls not being cheerleaders in Clareton High School. The other... It was kind of a dynamic black community. We did have a non-practicing lawyer because he had his law degree and he had passed the bar, but he didn't have any customers. We had a dentist. There was several physicians, and so there was a professional class of blacks who were part of the community, and. I didn't want to be a doctor or anything, so I didn't know any black scientists, so I said, well, I'll be a scientist. I took it as a challenge. I said, you know, we're not engaged in the scientific world, so I'll become a scientist. So I had good high school teachers in chemistry and physics and so forth. We even took trips to Carnegie Institute and Buell Planetarium in Pittsburgh. We were only 14 miles away. Now, the high school was very interesting because in those days, they bused white kids into the white high school. There were rural communities such as El Rama, Large, Pleasant Hills that did not have a tax base which was sufficient enough to support a high school. Clareton had the steel mill and a small chemical plant, so we had a tax base that could readily afford a high school. And so whites were bused in to Clareton High School from these rural communities like El Rama, Large, and Pleasant Hills. So that was, I found it ironic many years later that there was huge resistance in this country about busing black kids. But I had the experience where they bused white kids into the school. So, but, you know, those are some of the contradictions that one sees all the time in this society. The high school experience was interesting. In my graduating class of 317, there were 22 blacks. 11 went on to post-secondary educational experiences. 3 were honor students out of the 21 honor students in the school. 3 were black, and out of the 11 who went to post-secondary education, 3 earned doctorate degrees. My white classmates, 295, only 4 earned doctorate degrees. But we always felt that we had to do better to find a hospitable environment and a place for our professional interests. On graduating from high school, it was very interesting. At that time in Allegheny County, Clareton was part of Allegheny County, Pittsburgh is the major seat of Allegheny County, graduating seniors who finished a college prep course in high school, they had the opportunity to take a standardized examination, and those in the top 99 percentile, they were offered scholarships to Duquesne University, University of Pittsburgh, and Carnegie Tech at that time, which has morphed into Carnegie Mellon. Well, I was offered an academic scholarship to Duquesne University. So I go down for my interview in May of 1946, and I meet the director of admissions, and he goes into great detail honoring me for my high school contributions in terms of academics and athletics and so forth. Then I said, I won't call his name, he's dead now anyway, but I said, dear father, I said, since I come from a large family, I'd like to play football to defray some of the expenses, and I didn't want to commute every day from Clareton, which was about 15 miles away. So he kind of flushed and he looked at me and he said, well, you know, The university has scheduled North Carolina State, Clemson, Wake Forest, and some other southern schools. And if we have an athlete of color on the squad, they will cancel the game. And I said, well, do you mean to tell me that you will accept me full-time as a student, but then deny me the opportunity to participate in extracurricular activities? He said, well, I don't make the schedule. So I told him that under the circumstances, I could not attend his university. So I had a close friend from Denora, Pennsylvania, who was quite an athlete by the name of Daniel Towler. He later played with the Los Angeles Rams. And he called me up and he said, Coop, where are you going to school? I said, well, I don't have any school to go to now, and I'm not going back into the steel mills. And he said, well, why don't you try Washington and Jefferson College? So I went to Washington and Jefferson College on a football academic scholarship. Football took care of tuition, provided a room year-round, and provided board for 4 months out of the school year. So my standard of living increased by my going to college. I had a bed of my own. I didn't have to sleep with my brother any longer. No, it's really true. And so I went to Washington and Jefferson, and it was overall a good experience. The academics were very difficult. An A, for example, was from 93 to 100, and B was from 83 to 93. So they didn't give grades like a B minus or an A minus. It was either A, B, C, D, E, or F. And I didn't do like some kids who would tell their parents, well, F is for fine, D is delightful, A is awful, and B is bad. But, so I majored in chemistry, minored in physics and math. I had really wanted to be a chemical engineer, but that was a 3-2 program with MIT and Carnegie Tech. And so the athletic director said, well, Walter, said, I know you're ambitious, but we gave you that scholarship so you could play four years of football. So because I would have been leaving in 3 years to go, after 3 years, to go to MIT or Carnegie Tech. Well, anyway, on graduation, another shock came when I was thinking about going into the workplace. So the process at Washington and Jefferson College for recruiters was you pull together all of your documents, your resume, and so forth, and you deposited these at the recruitment office. And so when a recruiter came in, he would go through these documents, and if there was an individual whom he was interested in who might fit a need in their corporation, you were called over to the recruitment office. So I get this call. The recruiter from DuPont Corporation would like to see you. So I go over, and you learn to read body language. He was surprised to see me come in. So he pulled himself together, kind of hunched his shoulders. And then he said, well, I notice you have an excellent academic record. You are officer of your class. I was secretary treasurer of my class. And just an overall good student. He said, but I want to tell you, we do not hire blacks for our research labs at Wilmington, Delaware. And I said, oh my God, what have I run into? French named company, E.I. DuPont, Nemours. What's going on here? So I was very disappointed, and I started thinking, well, maybe I should go to graduate school. The other encounter, though, that summer, I had two major encounters. The Clareton Works of U.S. Steel Corporation had a summer hiring policy. The summer hiring policy was based upon the length of time that your father or your uncles or relatives had worked with the company. So my father had about 27, 28 years with the company, and the other black college students, their parents had similar years of tenure with the U.S. Steel Clareton Works. So we go down there, and they said, we're not hiring. you know, just brushed, put off. So I found out I had a high school classmate who worked in the personnel office at the Clareton Works of U.S. Steel. So she told me that, said, well, the chairman of the board of U.S. Steel is planning to visit the Clareton Works. So I got eight guys together who had been refused jobs. We were actually the Clareton Nine. This was 1950. So we were the Clareton Nine. So I put together a statement of concern that we were going to sit in at the personnel office, and when the chairman of the board came in at 4 p.m., we were going to hand him this statement of concern. So at 3:30, I could see the personnel people getting somewhat rested. So I pulled the guys together. I said, now, they're going to probably offer us two jobs. Nobody's going to accept it, right? Right. So about 3:45, about 15 minutes before the chairman of the board of U.S. Steel is to come, come to the personnel office, the personnel director calls me up and he says, gee, we've been calling around the plant all day. Finally, two jobs have showed up. I said, we aren't interested. Then two of my members walked up and said, we'll take the jobs. Defeated the purpose. So we left, and I told the two who had defected, I said, well, you know, I'm surprised, disappointed, and really hurt, because if my life had been at stake, I think you would have made the same kind of decision. So I got the guys together. It's seven of us now. And I said, well, we aren't beat. So I said, that was like on Thursday or so, and I said, how about Monday? We'll go to Fifth Avenue in Pittsburgh to the U.S. Steel's main office, and we will try to get an appointment with the chairman of the board of U.S. Steel. So we all get on the bus early Monday morning, when we go to the main headquarters of U.S. Steel Corporation, Fifth Avenue, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. So I go up to the industrial relations office and I said, I recognize that the chairman of the board is a very busy man, but we would like to have an opportunity to see him for 10 or 15 minutes. And the industrial relations man said, oh, well, what's wrong? And I said, well, I think the chairman of the board should be apprised of the discriminatory policy in summer hiring that is operative at the Clareton Works. He said, wait a minute, we can do something about this. So he calls the industrial relations director of the Clareton Works. I'll never forget his name. Name was Johnson. So he set up a meeting 2 days later, and we went in, and we all talked about the situation, and we all found summer employment. That pointed out to me the power of sticking together and demanding what is rightfully yours. You know, we weren't asking for anything special. We were just asking that the law or the policy be upheld for everyone. The second aspect of 1950, which was a big year for me, the college guys during the summer, we used to have a Cosmos Club. And it was designed to raise funds, you know, with a little Abner Hop, something like that, and support Little League Baseball and some other youth activities. So I come home and after college, and a 15-year-old comes up to me, and I said, how you doing? And he said, oh, I'm doing okay, but I have a problem. I said, what is it? He said, I'm on drugs. I said, you smoke the weed now and then? No, it's deeper than that. I'm on cocaine. This is a 15-year-old. So I get another, I said, we have to do something about this. So I get another college student, call his name. He was home for the summer. And I said, we'll get on the docket of city council and we'll read a statement of concern. So we put together a nice statement. So I get up and I read the statement. You know, we are deeply concerned about the proliferation of drugs in the community and the deleterious impact that it was having on the youth. And we exhort city council to be more diligent in terms of of getting rid of drugs and other asocial activities that are taking place in the community. So I thought I was doing a good public service. Next day in the Daily News, McKeesport Daily News, which is a newspaper in the area, and 2 days later, the Clareton Progress, spokesmen for every institution in the community lambasted me. They said, these guys have denigrated the good name of Clareton, Pennsylvania. They are here for only 3 months at best. They're in college. They don't know what's going on. And unfortunately, there was a black minister who had been in town only 6 months. He was part of the group lambasting me. That wasn't the half of it, though. I didn't mind that, but I would walk the streets and people would say, what are you trying to do? Tell people how to live? I said, no, I'm trying to protect the young. So I had threats on my life, but they did not materialize. I didn't even own a penknife, so... And I had a high school teacher who said she recognized what was going on. She said, well, I know the district attorney in Pittsburgh and can provide you with protection. I said, no, I don't need it. So that summer, I had a job, but I had been defeated in terms of trying to get the city to be more diligent in terms of getting rid of drugs. Just before going to graduate school, the police chief was up in the parking lot of Blair Heights. That was the low-cost defense housing where my parents and I lived, during the summer months. His name was Peter Orsini, and he called me over and he said, hey, Walter, how you doing? And I said, I'm doing fine, Pete. How about yourself? He said, I want to inform you that the city has taken over the management of the low-cost defense housing which the government built. And he said, and if you want your parents to maintain their residence there, you better pull back in your criticism of the city. And I looked him in the eye, and I said, Pete, I said, my parents will stay there. I'm not going to back off on my criticism of the city. And if anything happens to them, they'll be held to pay. And I walked away, and of course, nothing happened to my parents. I went on to a master's program at Howard University, and that was another shocker. I go to the capital of this great nation, and it's the most segregated, discriminatory city that I've been in. No downtown theater except one at DuPont Circle would admit you of color. And then they had an amusement park, Glen Echo Amusement Park, where blacks weren't allowed at all. And I said, how could this be? You have such an educated black community, yet you have all of these discriminatory policies. And the one hero in the town whom I saw at that time was Mary Church Terrell, who had been a graduate of Oberlin College in 1895. She was out every day protesting segregation and discrimination. And she was pretty old at that time, but she was always out front. And I had a great amount of admiration, and some historian should write a book about Mary Church Terrell. To give you some idea of what was happening, E. Franklin Frazier, the historian, was on the faculty at Howard University. And he later wrote a book called The Black Bourgeoisie, which he published in 1957. And it's kind of a scathing indictment of the black leadership in Washington, D.C. at that time. And I think some young historian or social scientist can make lots of money if you update E. Franklin Frazier's Black Bourgeoisie, 1957, update it in light of the socioeconomic and political changes which have taken place in Washington, D.C. It would make interesting reading. Oh, at the same time, now this 1950 is a tough year. Same time, the U.S. Army is trying to draft me for the Korean War. And I said, and this was before I had a summer job, and it was draft board number 2, McKeesport, Pennsylvania. So I took my letter down there, greetings, some of you who've had military experience, greetings, you are supposed to report for pre-induction physical at such and such a time. So I went down there and I handed the letter and I said, you made a mistake. They said, your name Walter Cooper? I said, yes, my name is Walter Cooper, but I don't have my rights, my democratic rights in this society, and the most crucial one is your economic rights, and I don't have any. So you're now asking me to bear my all on some barren hill in Korea for democracy, which, you know, I've never experienced. And I look up on the blackboard, and they have a name from my hometown, Kenneth Cook, draft dodger. I said, that kid's not old enough to even be registered for the draft. What Kenneth Cook had done, he had doctored his birth certificate so he could get a summer job. That's how desperate we were for to work. He was only 15, and he doctored his birth certificate to say that he was 17. So I said, leave him alone. So I said, well, look, I'm planning to go to graduate school. They said, we can give you a deferment, but we want you to take the physical exam. So I took the physical exam, but I was never in service. And I lost some childhood friends in Korea. They were part of the 24th Infantry Regiment, which was founded in New York State in 1825, an all-black infantry regiment. I finished up at Howard, and I came to the University of Rochester on a graduate fellowship. And it was a great experience for me because the chemistry and physics departments were international. So I had an opportunity to interact with physicists and chemists and others who came from the world. They had the chair of the physics department was Dr. Robert Marshak, and the chemistry department was Albert Noyes. Noyes was a part of a UNESCO committee, so they were internationally oriented. And it was a learning experience for me, too, because I had a friend by the name of Baldini, who was a physicist from Italy, and so we used to have discussions. And he came to me one day and he said, I don't understand American history. And I said, what do you mean, Baldini? He said, in Italy, when I took American history, they said that Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson were traitors. And I started thinking. I said, well, I've never read a history book in the United States that would call those two men traitors. And you start thinking about it. They were educated at West Point. They were on the federal payroll. And then they fought a war of insurrection against their country. So that's a traitorous act, but you won't see that in any American history book. All you'll see is Benedict Arnold was a traitor. And what did he do? He did the innocuous thing for money to betray the secrets of the defense around West Point. So, but our history books say, well, Benedict Arnold was a big traitor to his country. But we never call the Southern generals who were educated at West Point, were on the federal payroll and fought a war of insurrection against the country. So we're constantly dealing with the psychological problem where the information is not very accurate. It's been distorted. It's been treated. And so from my own readings, I think Howard Zinn, People's History of the United States, is probably the most factual history written of the United States. The U of R was great until I married and I was looking for an apartment. Oh boy, that was excruciating. My wife and I had our first son in 1953, and Ned had taught him at Penfield High School later on. But we answered inquiries for 69 apartments and were turned down for all of them. The last person to turn us down had an apartment for rent on Park Avenue, and she had been a survivor of the Holocaust. And she said, well, if you don't find a place for you and your family within a week, you can have the apartment that I will let. And so, but I found something that was convenient for me. It was on South Plymouth Avenue, and I could ride a bicycle to the U of R every day. So that solved that problem. My wife also was trained as a scientist, and she was the first scientist to run the mass spectrometer in the Kodak Research Labs. She started working there in 1954. So we had a pretty good, at that time, well, in the early 50s, we were working and trying to establish our careers, but I was meeting people also in the community, like Dr. William Jacob Knox, who was the second black PhD hired by Eastman Kodak Company in 1945. He was hired by C.E. Kenneth Meade. The first one was in 1943, a person by the name of James Lavelle, who had been a silver medalist in the 400 meters Berlin Olympics of 1936. So I became familiar with these individuals and got to interact with them at times to get some overview of what was going on with the company. Lavelle left in 1955. So it was Dr. Knox, and he was deeply involved in community activities. He was on the board at Bain Street Settlement. I also had my wife worked in a division where the wife of the division, one of the division heads, was president of the NAACP. Queenie Zorki. And so I'm a new employee at Eastman Kodak Company, so she thought that I should be involved with the NAACP. And it was a vibrant organization those days. It had a membership of over 3,000. And I'm talking about 1960. So in July of 1960, the school administration had a policy, at least announced the policy, where they were going to put 900 students on half-day sessions, schools 3, 4, and 19. At that time, only about 35 to 40% of them were non-white. So I was asked to write a statement of concern or protest. So I went before the Board of Education in July of 7th in 1960 and read a statement of concern. The concern was expressed in terms of we were only 3 years removed from the Russians orbiting Sputnik number one, and there was a great rush to revitalize the American educational system. People like Gerald Zachariasen from MIT and others were deeply involved in trying to revitalize the American educational system. So my argument was that the educational needs of these youngsters, given the potential of the times, was greater and not less. So all of our children should have a full day education. So the next day in the newspaper, of course, the Democrat and Chronicle came out and said that I had charged them with racial discrimination. And not once did I use the term race or discrimination. So my boss came in and he was all excited and everything, and I lost a wage increment at Kodak because of my participation. But to give you an idea of the quality of leadership that was involved those days, the president of the Board of Education was Judge Jacob Gittleman. He was a Mensa member and a reasonable person, and he understood what I was trying to convey. So I had lunch with him, and on August 20th of 1960, he was able to get his colleagues on the Board of Education to rescind the administration decision, and so the students had a full-day educational experience beginning the fall of 1960. But that was the beginning of my interaction with a group of educated young African Americans and also whites from the university. We had in 1959, with the involvement of Professor Richard Wade from the History Department at the University of Rochester, and a social committee, a social club called the Delta Russics, we had gotten Connie Mitchell interested in running for public office, Third Ward Supervisor. So we ran her first campaign, and we lost in 1959. In 1961, we ran a repeat, and we won, the first minority representative in county government. That was what encouraged me at that time. People would say, well, why are you, you're a scientist, why are you involved? I had to be involved because the society defines me as a social problem. I'll never forget when I was doing a term paper in high school on the Negro soldier's contribution to American history, and I would go to Pittsburgh, the Kennedy Library, and I'd go into the stacks, and almost invariably, if I look at a social science or a political science book index, you wouldn't see African American or Negro American. You would see, they would be a subtitle under social problem. So the society had defined you as a social problem. So I was defined as a social problem when I came here because I had a housing problem. So you either turn your back on it or you try to ameliorate it. And so I was involved in the process of trying to ameliorate some of the problem. And there were interested people across racial lines who were interested in the same problem. So we started political process, and there were a group of young people, the Obadiah Williamsons and the LaPloy Ashfords and the Hannah Storrs, the Barbara Ames. Her father was commissioner of health, but she was out front in terms of trying to bring about social change. Rona Kogan, John Steepy, and others. They came out of the university. They came out of the university because when I was a graduate student, they had a vigorous NAACP chapter on campus. The president of it was a young white girl from Albion, New York, Patricia Hathaway. And Langston Hughes in 1962 wrote a short history of the NAACP, and he cites the campus chapter of the NAACP at the University of Rochester being one of the most dynamic. It was dynamic because it had a good mix of whites, blacks, and international students. We had students from East India who would come to the meetings, and I'll never forget one physicist, Remendius, in discussing school segregation, and he said, well, if it's segregated and it's an evil, why don't you burn down the building? Shudder. That was his solution. You know, you just burn down a segregated building. But I think that was the foundation for the surge of interests and activities in the early 60s. I'll stop at this point because I can, you know, talk in ad infinitum about these things. You may have questions.
I have a question of clarity. When you were talking about them going with a half day in three schools?
Yeah, three, four, and 19.
And what was their justification for doing that in some schools?
They thought it was overcrowding. They thought it was overcrowding, but it was.
Each kid would get a half day, and so then.
Yeah, they would rotate them. Yeah, right. But unfortunately, or I would say fortunately, there were vacant seats in other areas of the district. They wanted to concentrate those kids, so they did not have the provision for transporting them to other other schools in the district.
Were those three schools predominantly?
About 35% to 40% non-white at that time.
But the rest of the schools were much lower.
Much lower, yes. And so they didn't want to disperse them throughout. And of course, what it led us to start looking at was the issue of de facto school segregation. The first case in the country was Paul Zuber had run it in New Rochelle, New York in 1959. So I was chaired a committee to look into it. So we looked at transcribed minutes of the Board of Education deliberations from 1930 until 1960. And there was a trend to decrease the resources available in the schools as they became progressively non-white. So we had Paul Zuber came here for a meeting. He was at that time chairman of the NAACP's Housing Committee, the New York State Housing Committee. And so he looked at the study and he said, well, you have more on the city of Rochester than we ever had on New Rochelle. So I talked to the president of the NAACP at that time, and I said, I'd like to at least reveal the content of the study to the executive committee. Unfortunately, he told me, I'm not going to embarrass my friends downtown. So that was the beginning of what I would call the decay of the NAACP, because the key chairmen like housing, Dr. Kenneth Woodward, youth council, LaPloy Ashford, community affairs, Dr. William E. Lee, and I was chair of the education committee, and I was left with no recourse but to resign my chairmanship. So the organization went into kind of a tailspin, and seemingly it hasn't recovered since. And I think that was unfortunate. The suit was filed May of 1962 in the 3rd Federal District Court under Judge Burke. And the day it was filed, and Judge Burke decided in favor of the NAACP. We had to run it through the state NAACP. John Sandifer was the lawyer, and another lawyer by the name of Brock. I don't remember his first name now. But so we had a de facto school segregation suit, and people like Jerome Balter and his wife Ruth, and of course people we have in this audience, I won't call them by name, were actively involved. And Balter at that time was advocating that to get rid of school segregation, you would have the pie chart, and each there would be sections out. And this is 1963 or 64. And of course, no one was listening. And that should have been the solution at that time to a vexatious problem. I think there was still discipline in the African American community then, compared to the lack of discipline now, and we had the leadership at that time, real educated people who had the interests of the total community at heart, and were definitely interested in doing the right thing. After the NAACP demise, the Young Turks, as they were called in a series written in the newspapers by Desmond Stone and Jack Germont, they founded another organization called the Monroe County Nonpartisan Political League. And so it was very active in civil rights, not only locally but also nationally. For example, LaPloy Ashford was one of the Freedom Riders, and he was beat up in Pascagoula, Mississippi. They had developed the technique of not harming you facially, but harming you internally. So he spent some time in rehabilitation. But he came back, and he became really the Deputy Commissioner for Public Safety. He was the first non-white representative on the Board of Education. Hannah Storrs was a school teacher, a very imaginative one. She she headed the Congress of Racial Equality, and you had young people writing letters expressing concern for issues which were real in the community, like Mavonia Daniels and others. I think it was very interesting times and a very active community. I think what differentiates us now is that if there is an issue, there would be a response from the community. unlike today, when you have an issue of, let's turn the clock back 3.5 to 4 years, when the county health commissioner budget no longer included money for staffing nurses in the schools in the city of Rochester, you put at risk 36,000 students, their safety, well-being, and certainly their security. What was the response of the community? Silence. United Church Ministry? Nothing. NAACP? Nothing. Urban League? Nothing. ABC? Nothing. And see, during the early 60s, I was a founding member of the NAACP. Dr. Knox was, and Ken Woodward, Manny Goldman, and people were just united in terms of trying to do some good. The other thing which I found to be very disturbing was when the horrific dropout rate was mentioned in the press, and I said to myself, well, where's the leadership? You know, they put me into exile. You know, they said, well, he's an Uncle Tom, he's an Oreo, we don't need him around like that. But there was silence. And what can be more morally compelling than for a population or a community to go to bat for its children? To me, I think you sent a message to the children, to the young people, that you don't really care.
So what do we do?
What do you think happened? What do we do?
Well, you asked two pertinent questions. The first thing, you try to find new leadership, young, vigorous, talented people. See, I think we became enamored with the idea that the guy in the street is going to liberate himself. There's no historical precedent for that. You see, it wasn't the gentleman farmer from Virginia or Pennsylvania or Massachusetts that ran the American Revolution. You know, it was the Thomas Paines and the Ben Franklins and the Peter Stuyvesants and the Madisons and the Adams brothers. And then you look at the French Revolution, the people who fomented it were the philosophers, Voltaire and Rousseau. You look at even the unification of Germany. It wasn't the farmer out of Bavaria. It was the classical and highly educated families such as the von Moltkes and the Stauffenbergs and the Bismarcks. You look at modern revolutionary process, the Cuban Revolution, Dr. Castro, Dr. Guevara, Dr. Urrutia, and the other small cadre, educated, knowledgeable people who had a vision and who had integrity in achieving that vision. You look at our own civil rights movement, Dr. Martin Luther King, the Bayard Rustins, the A. Philip Randolph, the Thurgood Marshalls. It wasn't a man in the street. The man in the street doesn't know how to liberate people. He's interested in liberating himself on a very narrow scale. So what we've done, yes, Henry, you go ahead.
You spoke earlier about the activity of the University of Rochester, NAACP.
Right.
You don't have that among NAACP. I mean, we don't have, unless now the surge for Obama is going to take place, we don't see that the young people even know what's going on in the world.
I agree with you.
And if they don't, they're so self-interested that they don't pay attention to the problems that people have every single day.
Yeah, and it's worse than that because they're going to face, no matter who wins in November, they're going to be faced with some horrendous problems in terms of everything. I mean, the country, you know, the infrastructure, the educational institution, healthcare system, these are huge problems. But where are the young? And I don't know. Maybe it's because there's no focus on those meaningful things which improve the public good. I just don't understand it. Though, well, maybe, you know, as an older person, to look back with kind of a, maybe it's an oversimplification of what was really transpiring those days. But I know there was great interaction between the university. We don't have the professors interact in the community like we used to. You know, you had Joe, what was his last name? You know who I'm talking about. Frank. Joe Frank and Richard Wade. We just don't have it. And you had organizations, you had an NAACP chapter. I have nothing against religion, but it seems as though now the gospel course has replaced the NAACP chapter or any other kind of social or political activity on campus. But I always figured that, you know, I never saw, and maybe I'm jaded, but I never saw how the gospel course on campus really was relevant to the educational life or really the business of actually networking. See, that's the thing that amazes me. I serve on a board of trustees of two colleges, and both of them have vigorous study abroad program. Can't get the black students to go. I have a political science teacher at Washington and Jefferson College, been running a program 9 years, and he takes them to West Africa. Now, you know, you shouldn't feel threatened by going to West Africa. I could understand it if the professor said, well, we're going to Argentina or someplace like that. But he said, well, we're going to West Africa, you know, Senegal, Gambia, you know, where... But they don't go. In 9 years, he's had one student of color go. Now, Professor Doody there, Konate, just took students from Hobart and William Smith to South Africa.
In Senegal.
And how many African Americans did you have on it?
In 5 years, we have two.
Two. It's as if they've kind of isolated themselves and won't join the world. You aren't going to live in a homogeneous society any longer. That is out. The world moves toward a greater heterogeneity. And if you think you're going to live in a small, isolated, all-black world, you're merely kidding yourself. I tell the students, I was at Nazareth, I'm sitting at a dinner table with four students from Nepal, two African-American students, and I said, I gently put it forth, I said, pardon me, are you planning to study abroad? You know, the college has study abroad program. Oh, no, no, we're not going. I said, well, why aren't you going? Well, I just don't want to go. That's the answer. And I said, look, you're seated at the table with four of your classmates. They're probably 14,000 miles from home. They understand the importance that you now live in a global economy. Why can't you see it? The newspapers talk about it. Magazines talk about it. And you don't see it? I don't know. Yes?
I went to the U of R, probably started in 76, and I had a big chip on my shoulder because I was a Rochester girl and I'd gone out of town for 1 year of college and then I came back, and I felt like the U of R was up on a hill and didn't know anything about the town, and it sounds like it was different a little earlier on, and now Seligman doesn't seem to just be making noise but really wants more, but the U of R has always felt to me as if it's like geographically isolated from the community, and it gets a lot of kids from elsewhere who don't know much about Rochester, and it is never, I felt, really strongly integrated into the Rochester community.
I would agree with you. There was a change in the 60s. It had its first black tenured professor in 1963, Dr. Marcus Alexis. And he was a wild man in this town. You remember Marcus, don't you? He was a PhD in economics. He was the second president of the Urban League. Under his tutelage, we had a three-day conference on the black family in October 1969. We covered every facet of the black family. We had experts come in. We had Professor James Comer from Yale University, who was an expert on community education. We had Henri Clark, the historian out of New York City, an expert on history of African Americans. There was also Roddy McDowell, who at that time was heading the Ocean Hill, Brownsville thrust in Brooklyn to develop the community school concept in New York City, which actually ended up in 32 community schools, but the oversight and the leadership was bad, so the legislature about 3 or 4 years ago just dissolved the community schools. But we also had James Billingsley, who had just written a book on black families in white America. I think that, I don't know, from my experience, I think we went through a transition where people became enamored with rhetoric. I can recall in 1970, I had spent time in the Small Business Administration, and I had gotten to know Senator Edmund Brooke from Massachusetts very well. And he expressed an interest in coming to Rochester to open up the membership drive of the Urban League in 1970. So the board agreed upon it, but the staff said, no, we would prefer to have Jesse Jackson. Jesse Jackson came in and he talked for 40 minutes, never mentioned the local Urban League, and left, and that was the end of it. The same experience in 1969. Madison High School was having problems with achievement, so they had a revitalization committee. And so I knew several people on the revitalization committee, and I made some suggestions. I became aggressive and made some suggestions. I said, there's Kenneth Clark out of City College of New York, an expert in the education of young children. He and his wife, Mamie Phipps Clark, had done classical studies on the education of young black children. In fact, they published a book in 1953, Race Awareness and Young Black Children, which was part of the amicus curiae in Brown versus the Board of Education in the Topeka, Kansas thing. It was Kenneth Clark, Jerome Kagan from Harvard, great educator, and Gerald Zachariasen was still around then. So I even got made copies of their bios from out of the American Men and Women of Science. So I gave them to this person, and I said, I hope you will share them with other members of the Revitalization Committee. So they brought Jesse Jackson in, and he and his staff spent 1 week, and the school closed a year and a half later. See, we interpret rhetoric for substance. We don't look for substance. And that's part of anti-intellectualism. Let's face it. We don't have an institution that promotes intellectual thought. You know, I kind of pull the chain of black ministers. For example, I'll see them and I say, hey, Reverend, you know, I'm thinking of opening my own church. I said the first thing we'd have would be a well-stocked library and a competent person to run it. I said, incidentally, is your church, does your church have a library? We're working on it.
Yeah. I'd like to take this a little bit personal.
Sure.
Because I think there is something about what has transpired.
Mm-hmm.
And what we've not been able to teach young people, which you've pointed out that you've shared in your own way, is that thing about sacrifice. What am I willing to give up? Most of the leaders you've cited were willing to give up something. For some reason, we have not been able to find a way to teach what to give up. So that becomes an issue that older folks have not been able to transfer to younger folks. And younger folks have not been able to pick that up because they're so self-absorbed in their own situation. So the question is, what do we get our young people to understand is important to give up and to stand up and fight for? Because the definition of being a social problem, which is incidentally, and a new vocabulary for me now, because I can see a whole lot of reasons why if you embrace the idea of being a social problem, you begin to understand that you must do something about that problem because you are defined as the problem. Does that make sense?
Sure, but on reflection, I think there was a transition that took place in this town. I would say from the latter part of the 60s. I think the intent was good, but the message that it conveyed to people was in error. When the Alinsky organizing group came to Rochester, they only had two priorities, and jobs and housing. Education was left out of the equation. And what happened, I would imagine what you're dealing with in the school system today are the older children and the grandchildren of that cohort of the late 60s, early 70s, who place no value on education. And I think that is what happened. And I'll give you an example of it. Kodak, in the late 60s, early 70s, ran a laboratory assistance program. Now, what was this program? It was to take high school graduates, minority high school graduates from the city schools, hire them at Kodak as laboratory assistants, give them a mentor, someone to train them and everything, and then once their economic situation stabilized, encourage them to go to college at night. Kodak would reimburse the tuition. Okay? So it was a free education. Now, it's been reported to me, out of 300 who were enrolled in that program, guess how many received a college degree? Give me a guesstimate.
10%?
I said 2.
You were right. Murray, you were right. 2.
What happened?
Pardon me?
What happened?
Well, you know, they started making money and having a good time, I would suspect. The opportunity was there.
So that sounds to me like a mentoring issue.
No, they had good mentors. I knew many of the people personally, and I mentored one person. Fortunately, he got a bachelor's degree in chemistry from RIT and a master's from North Dakota State in polymer science, and he's the director of environmental health for the Huntsman Corporation, with Canada and the United States being his territory.
Well, if I was running the mentor program at Kodak, and the first year, not one of those students was maintaining college, I would have brought all the mentors together and say, what are we going to do to affect that and not let it go? So that's why I'm saying, from my perspective, that there was a fall down in the quality of mentorship, the goal of the mentoring, how each of those took that seriously, and how the company took it seriously.
Yeah, but you see, we're dealing with what I call the Rochester syndrome. You don't measure anything. I mean, look, see, there are things I don't understand. A young man, 15 years old, he gets murdered, right? He's been to school only 12 days out of 4.5 months. He's 15. Isn't that contributing to the delinquency of a minor? You know, why wasn't something done? The school didn't do anything. The family didn't do anything.
That's my point, though, that there are people who are in charge.
I agree with you.
So, if I may, back to my original question.
I'll give you an example of what I'm talking about. For years, I, when Joe Calabrese was running United Way, and now the new person running United Way, I said, well, you fund agencies to provide direct services to families. In your year-end review, do you ever ask the question, what impact do your services have on the children's educational experiences from those families? You have readily measurable variables. And for example, attendance, achievement, suspension rates, frequency appearing in juvenile court, all of those data are available. But nobody does that because there's no accountability.
They still haven't even been able to qualify 30 groups still doing the same thing.
Well,
it's a whole...
Well, I would agree. Here's another one. You have Title I Parents Organization. The Elementary Secondary Education Act of 1966. There's a section called 1118. 1118 writes beautiful language about the role of parents in the schools. The feds take a pot of money, send it to the local district, say, all right, you hire a Title I parent administrator. Now, the school has a vested interest in that administrator not educating those parents, so those parents will have the courage and knowledge to demand accountability out of the district. So you have a built-in barrier to any kind of accountability. So who's kidding whom? I've talked to legislators about this. I would rather see, since literacy is a big problem in this society, in this community rather, I would rather see get rid of the traditional Title I parents organization, have weekend school for parents twice a month, 90% attendance expected, if they want their youngster to maintain the partial or full benefits under Title I of the Elementary Secondary Education Act. Because you want to accomplish two things. You want to improve parent literacy, and you also want parents to have some idea of their responsibility to the educational lives of their children.
You pay parents to come on those weekends?
Sure, the transportation is paid. All of that is, you
not
can do
transportation.
That.
Transportation. Do you pay them to come?
Babysitting.
Stipends.
Yeah, you can pay them stipends.
No, I said, who's going to pay for the babysitting?
You can do that because I was part of a National Science Foundation program called Statewide Systemic Initiative. I was a principal investigator. It was a $10 million program funded by the National Science Foundation. It was designed to work with 11 schools in the state of New York to revolutionize the teaching of math and science K-8. We had three schools in Rochester involved, 39, 43, and 55 at that time. It was a five-year program. At midpoint, 2.5 years into the program, we asked one of the schools to leave, and another one left on its own volition. Why? Because they didn't want to do any of the things that were stipulated in the contract for implementation. To give you an example, we had developmental programs run every summer at Rensselaer Polytechnical Institute. Two schools, the 43 and 55, very low attendance. 39, excellent attendance. Then you would ask the question, well, we expected you for staff development to attend the Rensselaer Polytechnical Institute to undergo further training. Oh, I became a teacher because I wanted the summer off. So, well, why did you sign up for the program? But the teacher at 39 became, in 1999, became the teacher of the year in the state of New York. And in 2005, became the Teacher of the Year in the United States. So I maintained contact with her, excellent teacher in math and science. I said, well, the methodologies which you've developed, do you have the opportunity to diffuse these methodologies to other schools in the district? You know what her answer was? No, they ignore me. So she's going to retire at the end of this year.
Is it possible that the resistance, and I can feel it because I've come across various aspects of what you've described as an ongoing condition that we have to walk in, whereby there is almost a resistance to bringing in anything that would uplift the kids to a different level. It almost seems as if this community has accepted the fact that investment in young people is not what they do. And that is a very serious statement about the condition that I find myself in as I hear you and as I've experienced it. Young people have also spoken. I remember Mayor Johnson, former Mayor Johnson, had a youth summit, and the conclusion, the synthesis of what young people said, and I know that Mayor Duffy just had a similar forum, but core to what they're saying is, this community don't care, and if you don't care, why should you expect us to care? So the question is, what, and I sat on the board of Monroe County Youth Bureau, mm-hmm. and I was really disappointed that less than $5 is invested budgetarily on a child in the county. Less than $5. So now we're talking about human and social capital development and investment in young people, and there don't seem to be some interest. What's going on?
Well, you've explained it. But you see, all education is for the future. And if you're talking about a future for your community, your state, and your nation, you have to have educated people. I think what I've seen in Rochester, the standard for performance has been set so low for these minority students that, if I make a C, I'm doing quite well. I'm not thinking about making an A. I'm thinking about making a C.
Passing the Regents now is 55. When I was in school, it was 72. I'm not sure what happened.
Well, I'll tell you what happened. I served 9 years on the Board of Regents. Every time we tried to upgrade the assessments, you get a fewer uproar from the teachers' union, the New York State Teachers Union, and sometime from, depending upon who's the executive director, the New York State School Boards Association, and then you get the political involvement. Before I left the Regents, I did an analysis of, school districts are always talking about mandates, unfunded mandates. I took about 300 mandates. I had the staff pull them out. And I analyzed them, and it was something like the commissioner's mandates were something like 32%. The regents themselves about 3%. Regents' mandates for educational change. The rest of them were legislative. And I try to tell people that your legislatures are the one that drives the mandates that are imposed upon local districts. But the other thing in this community that I find is that, you've had people of excellence, but you don't name streets or schools for people of excellence. We had the only black architect in Western New York for many years, Thomas Boyd, a 1927 graduate of Brown University, a master's in civil engineering from Syracuse, came to Rochester in 1931 to be interviewed by a engineering firm by the name of, I've forgotten it, Firestone or one of those places, and he sold himself. Prominent architect. There's nothing. These kids never heard of Thomas Boyd. You had Dr. William Jacob Knox, Harvard, bachelor's, master's in chemical engineering out of MIT, PhD in physical chemistry out of MIT, Manhattan Project, It was his group under Willard F. Libby, who later won a Nobel Prize in Chemistry for carbon-14 dating techniques. Knox's group found a way to isolate pure uranium from uranium hexafluoride. You don't hear anything. He was the first president he was the founding member and first president of the Rochester Urban League. Nothing. Whenever he died in 1995, I was asked by Chemical and Engineering News to write up an obit for him, and I didn't have a 5x7 picture. I knew there was one in the boardroom of the Urban League, so I called down there and I said, I'd like to come down, pick up the picture, have some prints made, and return you the original. And I was told, no, we'll do that. No, you don't have to come down. That was July 1995. Did I receive the prints as yet? No, I haven't, or the mailman has destroyed them. I mean, and that's the kind of performance you get out of these people.
Yeah, but Walter, what's money got to do with it?
Well, I think you need money, but you also need attitude. We need an attitudinal change. I think, as I was saying...
But wouldn't the money help?
Oh,
I
sure.
Mean, you know, we're living at a time when 1% of the income or gross national product, 1% of the people earn that.
Yeah,
50%, nothing. I mean, it's got to do with money, because if we could pay teachers better, if we could have smaller classrooms, if we could be better examples, it's got to have something to do with money.
But I think there's another part of it. I agree with you, but I heard Jules Sugarman, who was a co-author of Head Start with Ed Ziegler, I heard him give a talk in 1990, and he said, if this country expects a quantum jump in educational achievement of its children, it has to develop a social policy geared to families. See, the family is the primary determinant of educational achievement. All the studies that I'm aware of point that out. Mm-hmm. The Coleman 1966 study was a 10-year study, over 100,000 students, teachers, administrators, parents were looked at. He came to the conclusion that in the final analysis, the family is the primary determinant of educational achievement. In the late 1990s, the Department of Education in Washington had a study called the Early Childhood Longitudinal Study. They did a longitudinal study on these youngsters, 20,000 of them, 5,000 parents and guardians, and they concluded you could look at the student's achievement and it will tell you much about the family from where that kid comes. And of course, poverty may play a role, but it's not the solely determinant role of achievement. It's the family. See, because I grew up in the Depression, everybody was poor. I kid people that I lived on 3 square meals a day, oatmeal, cornmeal, and miso meal.
IWCA has an interesting program, you know, for unwed mothers. Mm-hmm. They're educating these young women. At least they will have an opportunity to be able to go on and become more literate, to be able to go to college, to get a job. I think that's a very valuable program.
But you know where I see some serious holes? The Museum Science Center used to run a program, and I was their speaker for a couple of years in a row. And they had a dinner afterwards, and you would meet with parents, and they were across racial lines. So I sat down with parents, and I would say, well, when your youngster was, these were middle school-aged youngsters, I said, have you had a chance to sit down with a counselor or something, or have you received at home a list of scholarships that are available to your youngster if your youngster achieves a certain grade in school, high school? No. It would appear to me, if you're really serious about children and their future, when a youngster reaches middle school age, the parent or guardian and the youngster should be made aware of the list of scholarships that they're eligible if the youngster graduates, say, with a 3.1, 3.2, 3.3 average. so that the youngster and the parents know that these opportunities are out there. I talked to a young lady. She's a junior or sophomore in a suburban school district. She's a 3.8 student, you know, and she's in advanced placement and stuff. And I brought up to her and her mother, well, you know, your daughter is interested in a scientific kind of a career. If she has a 3.3 average on graduation, she's eligible for Millennium Scholarship. Millennium Scholarship? What is that? You know, that's the Gates Foundation. When Bill Gates and Amanda Gates set aside over $1 billion for students, minority students, primarily African Americans, Hispanics, and Native Americans, if they achieve a 3.3 average, they have a scholarship right out. But there are all kinds of scholarships available, and these kids and their parents don't even know anything about it. I even advocate, for example, when students are even young and in the schools themselves, there's enough data to show that potential lifetime earnings of a dropout, a high school graduate, and a college graduate. You could have some nice design bar graphs. People don't have to be sophisticated to look at a bar graph and see things like this. Or incarceration rates, dropout, high school grad, college grad. That should be
put. You have to get to them, Walter.
Pardon me?
You have to get to them.
Well, but you see, I tell people in the school setting this all the time. I walk away and say, well, he's crazy. He doesn't know what he's talking about. Look, when I was working at Franklin, to tell you about this Title I Parents Organization, I meet with the parents. So I bring up the issue of average daily attendance and how it impacts on the funds coming from Albany, you know, general educational funds, based upon average daily attendance. Now, these are your most aggressive parents. They were part of Title I Parents Organization when their youngsters were in the primary grades, middle school, now high school. They, you know, to a person, they said, well, that's the first time we've been told that. So what does that tell me? That the Title I Parents Organization has been in failure.
By design.
By design. Well, and you see the other thing about it, too. You take this community. When I was at Franklin, 1998 until close to 2000, to try to restructure that school, you know, the pre-K to 5 Montessori, which was only the 6th Montessori program supported by a public educational system. A modified Montessori for middle school, and then at high school, the academies. 3 academies, international finance, global arts, and medical and tech. Yeah, bioscience, yeah. So the Gates Foundation became interested because it was a small school concept. So you get people, you get a new superintendent, and they start destroying the very fabric of the program set up. And nobody makes any complaints. We had a waiting list when it was started. We had a waiting list for the Montessori of 120 kids. Excitement. You know, we felt that if Marie Montessori in 1907 could do that in Italy with poor kids, then there's no reason that we should not be able to do it with poor kids in the city of Rochester. But see, I learned a lesson. You remember when I was on leave to set up the anti-poverty program with Herb Greenberg and Walter Lifton and Sister Jane Zeta? We had 3 preschool programs: Work Educational Training Center, Family Children's Center, Head Start. The incoming staff administrators were supposed to do longitudinal studies on the youngsters in those 3 preschool programs to determine when the youngster enters 6th grade, look at their performance, and say, which of the preschool programs, address the issue, which of the preschool programs best prepared these poor kids for the primary grade experience? You know how many data points were made? 0. That taught me a lesson. If you go out to set up something and you conceptualize a solution to a problem, if you're not there to implement it, it will never get done. It gets bogged down in people, you know, to draw a salary. Well, I ought to do this, but, you know, yes.
How do you address this issue? I walk into some meetings where I feel this is really an issue. How do you address this issue of, you know, there are things that we don't know how to measure. I mm-hmm. understand that.
Sure.
And there are things that are very difficult to measure.
Sure.
But so often nobody considers whether we're measuring or not. And I don't know. I get frustrated because I go into things where people are talking about there are funds available. There's this kind of thing where it's driven by there are funds available, therefore let us apply and get the funds and do something. Well, yeah, okay, better than doing nothing most of the time. But the idea that first of all, one of the things that goes wrong when you do that is you can put together an absolutely incredible program.
To you.
Well, to you. But even if it's incredible for the kids, or how does anybody know that? How do you justify the next person funding it when this person is done funding it, etc.? There's a tendency to just do stuff.
And not measure it? Is that your point?
And not measure even what is measurable.
But you know what has happened in this community, too. Mm-hmm. What I've seen happen in this community is the proliferation of 501c3 organizations, tax-exempt organizations. And Louis Slaughter is up in arms about that because Buffalo, for the Buffalo-Niagara region, they only have 1,200 501c3s. So what you'll find in the community is you'll find a group of three or four people who will set up a 501c3 supposedly to do some civic good, but nobody measures it. And there's no inspection on whether they're doing good or not. And that's a problem. I don't know how, for example, city council must have a discretionary budget where they'll take a certain amount of that budget and provide funding for a small 501c3 organization. To me, New York City is looking at that because a huge amount of dollars go out under that kind of process. And there's no accountability to it. And the other thing, what has happened, what I see, for example, I mentioned that the president of the Board of Education in 1960 was a judge. But if you look at the quality of the Board of Education membership from 1960 to, let's say, the year 2000, I think what you will find is a diminution of the quality of leadership. And this is, and I think this is really a problem.
I can tell you where that happened, because I was completely confused by that. I was a student in the schools when this happened, and what happened was the Republicans and the Democrats, mm-hmm. neither of them wanted to take either the credit or the blame for integrating the schools. It was a court order, and so all of a sudden they said, well, you know, our children are not a partisan issue. Well, neither are our roads, but partisan politics is how things get done. And so the Republicans and the Democrats both stopped vetting candidates, and we had that quote-unquote non-partisan board for a while, and it got to be such a mess that being on school board was not seen as an ambitious thing to do.
Right. Well, but once again, it goes back to leadership. And it's not only this community, but it's a national problem, or we wouldn't have had the person they call our president in for a second term. You know, let's be real about it.
You know,
it's the reality, it's the truth.
And I ask myself the question, how could a so-called literate electorate... And here's a man, you know, who's an empty vessel, but we put him in. And lots of people bragged about putting him in office. And it's, well, we have problems, but I think that the challenge ahead of us is somehow we have to We have to convey the message to parents and guardians that their children are dying. I mean, there's no place for their children if they leave school early or if they do not acquire a knowledge that is broad enough and deep enough to allow them to be integrated into an economy that's driven by knowledge and is worldwide in scope. Our children are so isolated, and the parents also, they have no connectivity to the institutions of the community. Where we are today, there, you know, there's a minority population. I bet many of the parents and guardians don't know within walking distance is the Rochester Museum Science Center. I fought the social service organizations and also the schools for allowing that kind of ignorance to take place. People have to be connected with institutions because many of these institutions are critical to the early learning experience of their children. And I brought this up with some people, and of course I got the rationale, well, they're busy working, and I said, yes, they don't have the money. I said, they don't need the money. I support a program at Rochester Museum Science Center. You know what it is? 10,000 community passes. That means that 10,000 people can go there free. You know, and it's a quasi, it's a small model of the Ontario Science Center, which is located in Toronto. So it's available to people. My grandchildren were visiting me from Vienna, Austria a few summers ago, and Buck O'Neill was signing autographs and baseballs at the Memorial Art Gallery. You remember that? I went there. I stayed there 2 or 3 hours. We were the only people of color in there. I mentored a school teacher for about 3 years, a relatively young African-American. And I would have him take informal surveys like, class of 25, how many of you know where the University of Rochester is located? Maybe 3. How many of you have access to a daily newspaper? Maybe 2. So it means if they don't have access to a newspaper, it means that their parents, whenever the state publicizes the performance of the schools, the parents have no idea the performance of the schools which their children attend. Of greater consequence, two years ago after Christmas, two questions were asked. Oh, what did Santa Claus bring you? Money, clothes, games. Out of 3 classes, 1 student received books. Of greater consequence and sadness was the fact that, oh, the question was asked, perchance during the holidays, did you visit Barnes & Noble or Borders? They did not know that they were bookstores. So it's sad. It's very sad. But I'm getting old. I delegate to the young amongst you the challenge to go out.
One last question. What do you think about the jazz festival that's starting tomorrow?
Well, it's good. It's a bona fide contribution to American culture. See, I think we often get mixed up in terms of black culture, but I see it as a subculture adaptation to the fundamental American culture. That, you know, jazz was created because, and the blues, because it came out of the experience of a people. And jazz would not have survived if it had not been for Scandinavia, Paris, because the music critics in the early 20s, you can go back to music critics in our major newspapers, and they said, well, what these people are playing, that's primitivism. That's no art form. So suppose, and this is what I tell kids all the time, suppose Jelly Roll Morton and Sidney Bechet and others had said, well, they said that we aren't playing. What we're playing is not an art form. Suppose you take the definition of what you're doing that comes from external to you and not have your own definition or your own agenda for what you want to do. You won't survive well. So, you know, the Louis Armstrongs and the others, Jelly Roll Mortons, the Lil Hardens and others, even the Josephine Bakers must have said, well, what I'm doing, I will continue out of the depth of my experience. I'll take this Afro-Cuban idiom I will refine it and I will call it jazz. I don't care what you say about it. And that became a reality.
Walter, I don't know if this is true or not, but I heard recently that Toyota was looking to put up a new plant.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't going to put it up in the United States, and you know why? Because they don't have enough educated people to run the plant, number one. And number two, Canada has a health program that's paid for by the government.
Right. And so we should have we see the problem. Politicians look at health care not as a right of citizenship or a privilege of citizenship. They think it's something that you have to pay for. And so that's where we go wrong.
Well,
thank you for your tolerance and your forbearance.
Thank you, Walter.
Good seeing you.
See you.
Yeah.
If you talk to the Walters, please give them my regards. I remember them.
Just
wanted to. You
were getting ready to go on a trip to Spain. I think it was your anniversary.
How are you? As a token of my appreciation, that was a lot. That's a huge presentation, and I guess we all learned a lot. Really wanted to, on behalf of all of us here and all the Baba members, give you this style. And it says, what can be added to the happiness of a man who is in health, out of debt, and has a clear conscience?
You can add money.
Thank you very much.
Well, yeah. My pleasure. I didn't say half of the things I wanted to say.
That's,
well, I have a lot of experience. I didn't talk about, you know, the Africa trip and the Small Business Administration. Spent time there. And so I have lots to say. Yet. So I'll be getting together with you again.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Part of the reason I'm in Rochester is because of Dr. Lewis.
Kid, my main man. I met Kid at 48 and I came here to graduate school. He was in medical school. My campus. I mean, I really miss those guys. That's the problem now. There's no good. All that died off.
So now, it causes me to reflect fondly, you know, on, you know, Dr. Aaron, you know.
I can remember he was chairman of the housing committee of the NAACP, and he gave a talk on about housing, and he made the term greedy landlord, and so we kind of shed at him and called him greedy landlord. So, are you at med school or
assistant? Yeah, I'm just a professional now.
Yeah. Oh, very good. Did you know Lionel Young? He used to be in med. He left and went to the university.
Actually, some of the faculty members at the University of Rochester, remember him. Some of the, I think it was pediatric radiology.
Yeah.
And my professor was